Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We're also very pleased to have here in the studio with us for this hour of Focus 580, W.S. Merwin. He is one of America's most widely read poets. He's also known as a political activist and also as a translator. He has written over 50 books of poetry. His most recent is titled The Shadow of Sirius, published by Copper Canyon Press, and has just recently come out. He, over time, has won a number of awards for his work. His first book of poetry was published in 1952, and he has won the National Book Award, the Bobbitt Prize, the Tanning Prize, the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Writer's Award, many others, and also the Pulitzer Prize. So he served as Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets. In 2004, he was awarded the Lannan Lifetime Achievement Award. He now makes his home in Hawaii, and he's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to take part in a conference on translation, Translating the Middle Ages. This is sponsored by the U of I's Program in Medieval Studies and the Center for Translation Studies. I also want to mention the fact that currently there is an exhibit of his papers titled Multiple Merwins, Poet, Translator, and Environmental Activist. That's on view at the Rare Book and Manuscript Library in the U of I Library. That's room 346. And he will be making some informal remarks at a reception in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library today at 1 o'clock. Now, that is free and open to the public, so anyone who would be interested in attending certainly should feel welcome. And as we talk this morning, you're certainly welcome to call if you have questions or maybe would like to talk with him. You certainly are welcome to do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you have questions, you certainly should feel welcome to call. Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. And I just had a very happy hour talking with Terry Gross.
I must apologize here. There was maybe a little bit of confusion. So we've got you doing back to, you're just finished with doing fresh air. And immediately the poor man was marched from one studio to this one so he could talk with us.
Well, she was having some technical problems in her studio to begin with, too. So.
Well, at any rate, thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
You, in one of the many interviews that I've read or articles that have some comments that you've made about writing, you said something that I really liked, and because I think it says something important about poetry. And this was, you said, poetry always begins and ends with listening. You listen for something only you can hear. It's not something you immediately understand. You write, Dewar said, to me, there's a big difference between prose and poetry. You read prose, but you respond to poetry by listening to it. It gets you in a way you cannot describe. I like that. And I think that in probably a few lines, that says really what poetry is all about.
I think I've always believed that. I mean, I think that poetry is coeval with the invention of language. I think it's as old as language. Because I believe that language, I believe, which is as good a way of approaching it as any, because nobody knows how did language begin. I believe that language probably began as the attempt to express inexpressible emotion. Very possibly terrible grief, rage, the strong feelings for which we feel when we say words fail me, grief or anger or in uncontainable lust or hunger or any of those things. What happens? Language is usually reduced to a vowel, to a howl of some kind. And the attempts to articulate it, in fact, that's what articulate means, to break it up into something that can be managed, are consonants. That's the beginning of language. What happens when a woman in Iraq suddenly sees that her husband and her son have been just killed in a bomb thing? Just one long howl of grief. There aren't any words in it. And the attempt to to control her and comfort her and constrain her are breaking it down into smaller sounds. And that's the origin of language. I think poetry begins that way. I think poetry is about, prose is about what you can say. It's about how, you know, you can describe the color of a book or a subject, you know, how we got here this morning. Grief, rage, love, anguish of loss, these are things that it's impossible to describe, and that's what poetry is about, is what cannot be said. I think that's the great difference between poetry and prose.
I think in this same article, you say some things about the importance of being able to hear it and have poets speak it out, read it,
yes.
Which makes me wonder, can you ever, by looking at a poem on the printed page, can you ever truly appreciate it, or do you have to hear it, maybe not necessarily read by the person who wrote it, but heard it, read it out, or maybe you read it out for yourself?
Yes, I think all those things happen. I think sometimes you can pick up something about a poem on a page. I think you can get some sort of, it flicks some prejudice on or off, you know. It looks as though it's attractive to read or it's not attractive to read. But finally, to really respond to a poem, you have to read it and read it slowly enough to, as though you were reading it out loud, so that you can hear it. So you begin to hear it. The moment as you begin to hear it, you know, take a sonnet of Shakespeare, take something very familiar. You can't read it like prose. You can't read it at that speed. You can't sort of speed read through it. Even you know, if it's very familiar, you can't sit down and reread it like that. I hear the way scholars read things sometimes, and they're reading it basically without feeling. But that's not reading it. That's parsing it. You know, reading has to do with response and a physical response that begins with hearing. And then, you know, we talk about a gut feeling. It does. You feel it in your what the Hawaiians call your na'au, you know, right around your belly button.
Yeah. And if you don't, does that mean the poem's not successful? Or if somebody does, then...
It means that the connection hasn't been made, but doesn't mean it can't ever be made. You may go back and suddenly... I mean, I can think of poems and poets that were familiar to me, more or less, over a period of time, and they never really meant very much. And then all of a sudden, I read them, and I get something that I never got before, and something wakes up, you know, something lights up, something. I hear something, you know.
You, as I understand, had some impulse to write when you were fairly young.
Yeah.
And I know that there are people who probably at a young age, there are people who are driven to paint, and there are people who are driven to write stories, and there are people who are driven to poetry. Why do you think in your case that was a direction that you were pushed or that you just went into?
I have no idea. I also wanted to paint. I wanted to be a painter, you know, but I didn't know it, and I never could follow through with that. I never learned anything about painting at all. I didn't stay with it. That was just through my first years in college. But I always wanted to. I always wanted to write poetry from the very beginning, and then I realized that whatever else I did, I was going to want to write poetry, and it became more and more central until I realized that that was what I wanted to do with my life. You know, and I was always suspicious of being a poet, and I still don't feel that. You know. I'm very cautious about saying that, and if I'm asked my profession, I always put writer, you know, and then I have to be pushed into a corner, what kind of writing and so on, because it doesn't seem real to most people that your life is based on poetry, and I don't want to explain it. You know, the more precious and intimate and close something is, the less I at least want to talk about it, you know. Thoreau said, "What is religion? It is what one does not talk about." You know, I've always felt that too. You know, if I believed in God, I wouldn't talk about it. You know, I would try to have my peace with And Thoreau, again, on his deathbed, one of the elders of the church came in and said, "Henry, what are you thinking about?" He said, "Wild apples." He said, "Don't you think you should be making your peace with your maker?" And Henry said, "We never quarreled."
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is poet, we'll underline that, poet W.S. Merwin. He's here visiting the campus to take part in a major conference on translation, which is also something that he is, a translator. And I will try to talk a little bit about that, too. Certainly people wanted to call in and talk with him. You could do that, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Could I ask you to read something for us?
You could, but before that, I'd like to say something. I'm going to take something and add to your book. There are essays accompanying an exhibition over in the Rare Books part of the library by Christopher Cook and Chatham Ewing and Dennis Sears about the three parts of the exhibit over there. And they're lovely essays. They're absolutely wonderful essays these people have written. I really recommend them if you're interested in the subject. What would you like me to read?
Anything that you like. It could be your choice.
Well, there's a poem that Terry wanted me to read in her interview, and we didn't have time. So I'll read it now. Shall I do that?
Yes, please.
It's page 84 in your copy.
All right. And I'll turn my hymnal to page 84. Yeah.
Well, because I see you leafing through trying to follow.
Yes, indeed.
It's called "To Paula in Late Spring." Paula is my wife. "Let me imagine that we will come again when we want to, when it will be spring. We will be no older than we ever were. The worn griefs will have eased like the early cloud through which the morning slowly comes to itself, and the ancient defenses against the dead will be done with and left to the dead at last. The light will be as it is now in the garden that we have made here these years together of our long evenings and astonishment."
It's a beautiful poem.
Thank you.
It's a love poem.
Yes.
Forgive me because I'm sure that I have asked of other poets, and I'm sure that people say things after they hear something like that. They say, "Well, tell me about where that poem came from." And I know that that's... I'm not sure if that's actually possible to even answer a question like that. Well, where did that poem come from?
Well, of course not. And I think poems come from what you don't know. I think all real poems come from what you don't know. Suddenly you know part of the poem and you don't know what that... Everything you know is a part of it. I mean, I know what garden I was thinking of, and I know what moment of the day I was thinking of, and I know all of that about it. And I think of our years of our evenings and their astonishment at being there. I sometimes feel the strange fortune, this is part of the poem too, of our, this is something you and I share. Mm-hmm. Here we are doing what we want to. You're in your studio, and we're talking to each other. And we're not trying to kill each other, or put each other down in some way. There's no sort of animosity visible between us. The world at present, an enormous amount of the world is trying to kill each other, and just trying to destroy each other. This too is human behavior. What fortune is it that allows us to do this and visits that pain and that anguish and that grief and that suffering on them? I don't know. I don't understand. I don't understand. This is one of the great things that I don't understand. Why fortune distinguishes in these particular ways. It certainly is nothing that I deserve I don't know about your desserts, but and I'm sure that some of the people who are engaged in this suffering, including the people who are involved on both sides in the Iraq conflict, for example, did nothing really. I mean, they're all thinking that they're doing what they have to do, what they ought to do. And some of it's terrible. Some of it's frightening and with terrible life-defeating anguish in the whole thing. What makes the difference? I don't know. And out of that, that kind of not knowing, poetry comes and the arts come, and that's part of the mystery. How come, in some lives, it ends up with the arts, which are these great magnificent rephrasings of the question. They're none of them answers. And how come some lives never get any of it? I simply don't know. But I'm not letting that question alone.
You, in something else that I read, you said something that really struck me, and it was you made reference to something that Ezra Pound had said to you about writing, and that it was not a chance thing, but I noted down the phrase, it's a kind of spontaneity which arises out of discipline or continual devotion to something.
And yes.
Again, I like that because I think that we have this idea that, you know, a poem, it's like the apple dropping out of the tree on Newton's head, you know. It's something that comes like that. And while what I understood from this that, and yes, there is inspiration, yes, there is spontaneity, but that it's something that comes out of a long period of working at trying to say things in this way so that you can't, the muse doesn't just come and whisper it in your ear.
Yeah, well, look at the spontaneity of a great ballet dancer. It looks as though it happened just at that moment, you know, that motion, that movement across the stage, the steps and it looks as though it was invented as you see it. And of course it's a whole life of practice and of over and over and over doing something until it comes alive, until you can get it. That's the spontaneity. The apple dropping on Milton's head is the same thing. We know the moment when the apple hit him on the head, but in fact it had to start as an apple blossom. It had to, the apple blossom had to make that particular bud. That particular bud had to grow through rain and three seasons of the year. And Newton happened to be sitting under that apple at that time that it hit him on the head. All of those things are part of it, and they're part of the spontaneity of that moment. But if any of it hadn't been there, and I think that that's true. I mean, I think that when an Eskimo stood up in the lodge in front of Rasmussen and suddenly said a poem that nobody had heard before, the Eskimo man or woman didn't invent it at that moment. He may have been sitting there all winter long thinking about those six lines. Basho's haiku are the same thing, you know. The famous frog in the pond haiku is a fairly late one when he got the art down to, so he's really in command of it. But it had taken him all his life, and he sometimes rewrote those. We know that he sometimes rewrote those haikus over a period of years before he got it the way he wanted it. Mm-hmm. And they seem to be. So simple that they couldn't be any simpler, and they are. But that simplicity doesn't happen easily. I mean, I once had a musician say he was bored with Mozart because he was so predictable, and I thought, oh, is that so?
Do you go back and read older poems again and take them apart?
Of mine?
Of your own?
No.
So you don't. Once you've done that, you don't go back and...
No, usually, especially if enough time has elapsed. Sometimes, if they're fairly recent, I may think, "Oh, that word or that thing, I can do better than that." But not more than that. And I think that if you go back, if I go back more than a few years, I'm not the person who wrote those poems anymore. and I can't. With translation, it's a little different. In fact, there's a lovely essay in this little collection of about. I was delighted to see that he took the first translation I'd ever made that I saved and published, which was of the Richard Coeur de Lion prison song, a troubadour poem. And in the recent book, The Maze of Ventadorn, which was about 6 years ago, I retranslated that poem the way I would like to have it now, which was much simpler and every bit as formal, but not so sort of brocaded and stiff and all those things. And I thought, you know, I was much stuffier and stiffer when I was 20 than I am now. I mean, I couldn't bear that stiffness and stuffiness.
Well, you know, just as a way of trying to prepare, one of the things that I did was I dipped into Sir Gawain, your translation of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which now I want to go back and read all of. This was a poem from the Middle Ages. Don't know who wrote it.
No.
We don't even know exactly when it was written.
Pretty much.
We pretty much know when it was, around 1400, something like that. And the thing that really struck me about your translation was its plainness, in a sense. And while I feel that it conveys the fact that this was not written last week, somehow to me that it's not as ornamented and baroque, you know, as you might imagine somebody might do if they were trying to reproduce something from the Middle Ages. I thought that was very interesting. I'm not exactly sure what I was expecting.
I went back to the Gawain after the Purgatorio, which Pinsky and I are going to be reading Dante translations later this evening, and talking about them. And Dante, who's been central to my life since I was a student. Dante led me back, being close to Dante with the Purgatorio, that close to him after years of reading Dante. I went back and reread the Troubadours again, which I hadn't been doing it for about 20 years. You know, I read them a lot when I was much younger. I think we don't realize the degree to which we're indebted to the Troubadours. I mean, the entire Romance tradition begins with Guillaume de Poitiers. And with one poem, you can trace it back to one poem. I mean, Bessie Smith comes out of that whole thing. You know, all these assumptions about love poems in the Western world go back to romance, to those first three generations of the troubadours. So I went back to them. And then I thought, you know, it's very interesting that these guys in the third generation of the troubadours know all about the Celtic material. They know all about the Arthurian cycle. When Bernard de Ventadour has a jongleur, his code name is Tristan. And they know this. They know these stories backwards. How come? And I found, I was reading back through some of the books about it, in From Ritual to Romance, you know, that great 1908 book that was so influential to Eliot. She talks about this one Welshman. Whose name is, there are various spellings of it, but he was a Welsh nobleman who traveled among the courts of Normandy and got down to Guillaume de Poitiers. And Guillaume de Poitiers loved him and kept him down there. And he told all the stories he told all the Arthurian stories. And out of that, the early troubadours obviously sat around and listened to all these things. And they knew all that material cold. And it's wonderful. And I thought, well, I want to go back and see now one of the great Arthurian stories at the end of the tradition, rather than at the beginning, when all of the transformations have happened, when it's been to the continent with the Normans and has come back again. And that's what this is. You know, there are four manuscripts in the major manuscript that contains the Gawain poem, Gawain is the greatest of the poems in there. But there's Pearl and Patience and another one. Then I thought, well, you know, the translations managed to convey There's a Marie Barof one, and Marie Barof very carefully keeps the alliteration patterns of the original, which is like keeping the rhyme and meter and everything. Mm-hmm. But I thought, this isn't a poem. This is, if you heard this, this couldn't have been what they were hearing, because they were hearing something that was so exciting it kept them on the edge of their seats, you know, if you read this out loud. What would it have sounded like? And I thought, I wonder how, you know, I just took the opening paragraph and thought, see if I can get close to what the sound might have been. And I started trying to translate it. And, of course, I got hooked and tried, and I wanted to do the whole thing, because it's one of the great, the first scene of the Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is one of the most frightening scenes in literature. And I thought, wow, you know, I want to go on doing this. Yeah.
It sounds as if your impulse was, your basic impulse was, this is a great story. I want to tell a great story in a way that would keep people listening.
Yeah. Which is what it was. I mean, which is what those were, whether it actually was ever read out loud, it was written as though it was to be read out loud, the way in a tradition of reciting poetry to audiences which were often basically illiterate. I mean, knights and soldiers and people like that, you know. And these were the things they wanted to hear, were the stories like this one. It's a scary story, you know. I mean, the Green Knight is a very scary figure.
You know, you have translated a lot of, to say great writers may be something of an understatement if we're talking about Dante and Neruda and people like that. Is there ever, do you ever have any impulse to do a little rewriting? That is to say, you know, not just trying to convey what they wrote, but say, well, I know what you meant, but I think I can just make this a little bit better if I do this.
Well, in the 60s, you know, people took enormous liberties. I got a little bit anxious about that and thought we shouldn't call them translations if we're going to do that. Mm-hmm. It's okay to do it, mm-hmm. but you should make it clear that you're not translating. You're doing a version or some other word, but not. I mean, translation, after all, is used to mean anything from a pony to heaven knows what, you know, any kind of moving of something into the second language. And it's confusing. And to say that some of these very, very free ones are actually translations. I mean, they're poems of Lowell's that started as translations and become something else, you know. Lowell was toying with the idea the whole time. And some of his early poems in his first book, there's a Propertius poem of his, A Ghost is Someone, Death is, which is taken out of a Propertius poem and redone as a poem of Cal Lowell's. Mm-hmm. And it's one of his loveliest poems, I think, too. What's it called? I can't remember. Anyway, it's there in Lord Weary's castle. Yeah.
For benefit of people who are listening, we're a little bit past our midpoint, and I think I should introduce again our guest, W.S. Merwin. He's a poet, translator, has been known also as a political activist. He has written over 50 books of poetry and many translations. I think the number I came across was 20, but I think that's probably not current. Many translations. He's here visiting the campus for a conference that's sponsored by the University of Illinois Program in Medieval Studies and also the Center for Translation Studies. This is a conference translating the Middle Ages. And I also again want to mention that there is this exhibit of some of his papers, Multiple Merwins, Poet, Translator, and Environmental Activist, that's now on view in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library. And he will be making some informal remarks. There will be a reception in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library from 1 to 2 this afternoon. This is free and open to the public. Anyone who is interested should feel welcome to stop by. And if you're interested in reading some of his work, you can head down to the library or the bookstore. You might also want to look for his most recent collection. The title is The Shadow of Sirius. Copper Canyon Press is the publisher. Would you favor us with something else from the from the book?
You got any preferences?
No. I would leave the choice to you.
let's see. there was a poem that another friend of mine wanted me to read. How about gray herons in the field above the river?
All
that's
right.
On page 95 in your book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the herons that are speaking. It's the birds that are speaking. Now that the nights turn longer than the days, we are standing in the still light after dawn, in the high grass of autumn that is green again, hushed in its own place after the burn of summer. Each of us stationed alone without moving at a perfect distance from all the others, like the shadows of ourselves risen out of our shadows. Each eye without turning continues to behold what is moving. Each of us is one of seven now. We have come a long way sailing our opened clouds, remembering all night where the world would be. The clear, shallow stream, the leaves floating along it, the dew in the hushed field, the only morning.
How, I wonder, do you think about the structure or the form that the poem was going to take? And maybe over time, how have you maybe thought differently about that?
I think the structure is something that I hear as it happens. I mean, I don't have a structure in mind to start with usually. And what I do have is some words and a flow of words that I hear. And then I begin to hear what came before them and what comes after them. And then I begin to, I suppose, think about the form that they're gravitating toward and that they coalesce toward. That changes. That can change. And and as I begin to put it down on the page, that can change too. I think it's clearer if these are separated. It makes the emphasis. You know, back in the 60s, I became impatient with punctuation in poetry. And this is not a formula or a recipe that I am trying to foist on anybody else. I don't know whether anyone else should do this or not. But I became impatient with punctuation, which I thought really was part of prose. It belonged in prose because I thought that poetry is older than writing. We had poetry long, long, long before we had any kind of writing at all, and poetry was passed on, and passed on and on and on by people orally to each other. The spoken aspect, the heard aspect of poetry, is absolutely essential to poetry. It's much more important than the written aspect of poetry, which comes much later. And I just wanted to get rid of some of the unnecessary punctuation. Little by little, I used less of it, and finally, I stopped it altogether. Well, if you do that, that means that very thing is already a new form. Mm-hmm. The moment you do that, you have to do what the punctuation does in another way, which means that somehow, with line breaks, with the way you hear it, you have to hear it very clearly, so that when we talk to each other, we don't use punctuation, do we? We don't have little commas in the air. Some people put quotation marks in the air. It always irritates me a bit when they do that. But basically, we talk without punctuation. And we punctuate by the intonations and the breaks and the pauses and the all of the gradations in our speech to each other. And we understand each other that way. And I think that's older than written language and punctuation. So I wanted to move poetry back in that direction. But of course, the moment you do that, it means that you have to make the written poem do what the punctuated poem did, but you have to do it in a different way. And so the line breaks become very important. And the way the line flows on the page and the way... And then, of course, it meant that for me, most poems were a single sentence. They move from one end to the other. You don't have to read them as a single sentence, but you can. Otherwise, it's confusing. If it's confusing, it's usually that you haven't heard it. And then if you try to read it out loud, it becomes clearer. So many people have said to me that, oh, I read it out loud, and then it was perfectly clear. And I thought, that's it. That's the non-secret secret.
This particular poem, it reads like, it sounds like, it's simply, in a way, you're simply telling a little story about something that you experienced. Is this, in fact, what that is? Did this actually, you had this moment, you stood in this field, it looked like
no,
this.
No, because it's the herons that are speaking. It's not me. It's the herons. It says we. We are each of us now is one of seven now. There's seven herons standing in the field.
So was this, were you standing in the field at some
no.
point looking at herons?
No, I was looking at the herons. Paula drove down to town to get the newspaper and came back and she said, absolutely amazing, you know, there's this field with these herons. And we drove down the next day and there they were. And we just stood there amazed and watched them. And I've watched herons before. They're very strange. They're magnificent birds, and they're migrants, and they have this quality of stillness and motion compressed into one. I mean, they have the whole thing right there. And there were seven of them standing absolutely equidistant in this unmown meadow. Just over the edge of the meadow, there was a bluff, and then there was a little river, mm-hmm. about as wide as this room. And there they were. And obviously they went down at some point in the day when there was nobody around and fished in the river and then came back and stood in the... And then they would go up into a tree. But they like to stand in the long grass. And sometimes you watch herons... And they seem utterly still. Then you realize that the only thing that isn't still is your reflection in their eye, and they're seeing everything, you know, only in one eye. The other eye is watching something else. They're very mysterious creatures. And we don't know much about their migratory patterns either. They migrate. They're, like most birds, there are fewer herons than there used to be. And... Of course, they used to be hunted falcons. I mean, you know, they were hunted by hunters with falcons and eaten, but not much. But that's not what's killing them. I mean, it's pesticides and people netting them and all those usual things. And it's human beings that are destroying the herons.
We have a call here, someone who would like to talk with you. If you would grab those headphones and put them on, that way you will hear them. I hope that they're not up terribly loud. How's that?
No.
Comfortable?
Yeah.
Good. Well, let's talk with this caller. This is someone who is in Champaign. It's on line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I'd like to ask a question that I think ties together the three areas of interest mentioned earlier, poetry, translation, and environmental activism, and that's to inquire about the medieval attitude of man's relationship to the natural world. And I'm thinking particularly of the contemporary idea that seems to be very popular in translating God's charge to man in Genesis. It was earlier translated as dominion, but is now being moved more towards an idea of stewardship And so I'm sort of wondering if the medieval attitude reflected that former understanding of dominion over the earth and the idea that earth was put here primarily for our use, or whether it's something that we should manage for its own sake or something else entirely. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks very much.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. And I think it's a very complicated one, and I think that the answer is unfortunately very complicated too. I think that I got a chance. One of the great pieces of good fortune of my life was stumbling upon a tiny French farming peasant village in the 50s, early 50s, which has been part of my life ever since, and where we try to get enough frequent flyer miles to get back to at least once a year and spend some time there in an old farmhouse looking over the Dordogne Valley. Seeing the now vanished peasant world, which went really in some ways back into the Middle Ages, and the practical way in which this was worked out. It was a total assumption that these people, that the world was there for them, for human beings. On the other hand, the only way they could have a world for themselves was to take care of it for everything else. So it was still a world in which every peasant family had a little bit of arable land, a certain amount of pasture land for sheep and cows, and woodland and open country up on the upland behind the village, where they cut a bit of firewood in the latter at the end of the month of August, but everything, they were aware of the limits of everything. And you didn't take too much of anything. You didn't destroy things willingly. And if they hunted, every bit of what they hunted was eaten or used. It was not a painless or a totally comfortable existence for themselves or for their animals or anything else, but it was a contained and sustainable life. It's a life that had been sustained for centuries, in spite of terrible political situations and of wars and of all sorts of things. It went back into incredible antiquity. The first Neanderthal skeleton was full, complete one was discovered there in 1908, just across the river. So it's very, very ancient area. And I think long before the Book of Genesis, there was this feeling of how you could live in a place and keep the place for yourself selfishly, and at the same time keep it alive for itself. And I think these two things related. I mean, this idea that the world is stewardship, we're coming to that very slowly and late, and maybe too late. And I don't think it's there in the Book of Genesis. But I think the way the Book of Genesis is written was quite late, too, and came out of an older civilization. This is a question that we have been trying to work out for a very, very long time. And the hunter-gatherer civilizations looked at it one way. The great destruction really began with the age of agriculture and the idea that the earth actually belonged to us and that we could change the whole earth. I believe that gardening, for example, is much older than agriculture. It's not the other way around. That we managed to gather things from and change plant a few things in forests long before we tried to cut down the forest and make it turn it all into arable land and say this is our field and you keep out of it and kill all of the animals that come into it. I think this is a very, very complicated question, and if we can't solve it better and faster than we're doing, I'm not sure about our survival at all. because the idea that the environment is a sort of marginal issue and that we can get around to it like a hobby somehow, wouldn't it be nice to save these things? If we get rid of the environment, we get rid of ourselves. It's everything that we do to the environment, we do to ourselves. And we have to wake up to that, or our time is very limited.
And I'm sorry to say we're coming down to just having a couple of minutes left. The relationship between people and nature, where the disconnect is something that I know has been important to you as a theme, something that you've written about for a very long time. How, in for you, where did that interest come from?
It's mysterious. It seems to me that it must be natural. Everybody must have it, but I don't know. But I remember noticing grass between the paving stones of the sidewalk as a child, and as a very small child, and saying to my mother, "Where does that come from?" And she said, "The earth is under those stones." And I've had a great feeling of joy, you know, and it gave me a feeling of freedom to be part of that. I reached down and touched the grass. I remember thinking, it's all there, you know. And I've always felt that. And don't you think it's natural for children to feel that? Or is it gone? I mean, are the computers so fascinating that they're not interested in animals and leaves and...
I think that they are, and I think, and I know it's something that people worry about, is that they would say the opportunities that children have to have that, make that kind of connection are fewer and fewer. And whether it's because there are
it's
other
true.
Things that distract them or just our opportunities to encounter nature are fewer and fewer.
Well, I remember being shocked years ago to realize that I had lived to see a generation where no child that I spoke to, no child that I met, would ever have seen a wild animal. The only wild animal they would have seen would have been a cockroach on the kitchen floor, you know. And that to me is really troubling. I think this is a very dangerous point to have got to.
We are coming down to the point we have a couple of minutes left. Would you maybe read one more thing while we have a couple of minutes left?
Mm-hmm.
And this is, he is reading from his most recent published collection, The Shadow of Sirius. This is just out. Copper Canyon Press is the publisher. I'm sure you can find that in the bookstore and with the library and some of his other work as well. So I would say go out and look for it.
Well, how about a poem called Falling? Mm-hmm. Long before daybreak, none of the birds yet awake. Rain comes down with the sound of a huge wind rushing through the valley trees. It comes down around us all at the same time, and beyond it there is nothing. It falls without hearing itself, without knowing there is anyone here, without seeing where it is or where it is going, like a moment of great happiness of our own that we cannot remember, coasting with the lights off.
One of the things that I don't even know if I have time to ask you, I was just interested in having you talk a little bit about the place that you live in, Hawaii.
I love it more every day, and it's we're very lucky. I mean, it's what the good fortune I was talking about. I managed to get 3 acres years ago in the mid-70s, and then two old ladies next door, when they knew we didn't want to develop the land, we managed to get it for less than the assessed value of the land. They practically gave it to us. And so we have 18 acres, and we don't see any other houses, and I want to save that valley because it hasn't been touched since the Hawaiians were there. And I planted many species of trees. Our garden has actually managed to save one species from extinction. And I want to save those trees, those palms, and that valley, if I possibly can. It's moving in so fast, the development and the homogenization of everything, turning it all into Southern California. You know that anything we can save should be saved just as long as possible. I mean, I think. if we possibly can do it.
Well, we must stop because we're here at the end of the time. Our guest, W.S. Merwin, has written over 50 books of poetry, prose, and translation. He has won many awards for his work, including Pulitzer Prize. His most recent collection is The Shadow of Sirius. The three poems that he's read this morning are in this and many others. Copper Canyon Press is the publisher. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois for a conference translating the Middle Ages that's sponsored by the Program in Medieval Studies here at the U of I and also the Center for Translation Studies. And I will mention one more time that also in, there is an exhibit of some of his papers, Multiple Merwins, Poet, Translator, Environmental Activist, that's on view in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library. That's room 346 of the library on Gregory Drive in Urbana, and he will be making some informal remarks. There will be a reception in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library this afternoon from 1 to 2. It is free and open to the public, and anyone interested should feel welcome to attend. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.